Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to Space Chunk. I'm Annie Hanmer, and I study international and interdisciplinary cooperation in space at the University of Sydney's School of History and Philosophy of Science. In this episode, I bring you part one of a wide-ranging and delectable conversation with fan favourite and good friend Dr. Benjamin Pope. Ben has a PhD in astrophysics from Oxford University and is currently a NASA Sagan Fellow at NYU researching exoplanets. In this episode, Ben and I tackle an inadvisably large number and bewilderingly wide range of space movies. Do either of us have qualifications in film studies? No, but Ben won university challenge and I took drama in year 11, so that has to be good enough. Some of the references in this episode are a little out of date as it was recorded some time ago, notably Trump's worst ideas so far. You'll know it when you hear it. As usual, Ben's vocabulary is vast and includes the occasional swear word. There's nothing to be done, I'm afraid. You have to take your astrophysicist as you find him, sweary or otherwise. As always, I'm required to say that any opinions expressed by me on this podcast are my own and do not represent the views of any organisation with which I'm associated. This episode is certified 100% tardigrade free, unlike the moon.
Should we talk about space?
Let's fucking talk about... Should we have an intro and then a talk about space?
We could, or we could just make this the intro.
Maybe the intro is just like, stop trying to make race science happen. It's not going to happen. I don't know.
Amazing.
I had so much coffee today.
Yes, that's right. So, Ben, why don't you tell us why you've had so much coffee?
Well, I've had so much coffee because I am astonishingly jet-lagged. Over the last 6 weeks, I have been back and forth between Sydney and New York 3 times. I think my circadian rhythm recently has ceased to be, you know, some kind of 24-hour cycle, really approached a quantum state where it's not that it's trying to adapt to whichever city I'm living. That's actually a superposition of all of the different cities I've been to in the last month. And I actually have no particular circadian rhythm in a definite sense. I'd still like to explore the mathematics of that, but I don't understand them or why I feel garbage all the time. But maybe I should stop doing this.
Sorry. The last time you were on this podcast, we recorded 2 episodes because we just got really carried away.
Yeah.
One was on Space Force.
Space Force. The worst idea that Donald Trump's yet had, apart from all the racism.
And the next one was on the Humanity Star.
Well, you talked me around on the Humanity Star. I hated the Humanity Star to start with, and you talked me around to ambivalence.
I don't know that I intended to talk you around to anything. I'm not sure how I feel about it still.
But that's all right, because I was sure how I felt about it, and you convinced me that I should be unsure.
So, I thought that I would get you back again, give you tea, bribe you with chocolate chip bikkies.
I feel very sorry for Earl Grey. He gets to be the Prime Minister and is mostly remembered for tea.
That is an absolutely wonderful thing to be remembered for. Mm. Earl Grey tea is fantastic.
If you were the Prime Minister, wouldn't you be rather remembered for abolishing slavery than for a particular variety of tea?
That's a trick question. Both of those things are good.
Good.
It reminds me of Skyfall, where Q is saying that I could do more damage sitting in my pyjamas with my laptop before my first cup of Earl Grey than you can do in a year in the field.
I found that interesting, the way in which we class tea, that, you know, Q has Earl Grey, or Captain Picard likes Earl Grey, doesn't he, in Star Trek?
I don't know. Because, I haven't watched it closely enough, clearly.
Because he always got tea, Earl Grey, hot. I can't do the voice. Basically, I haven't watched Star Trek very much either, and we can talk about this in a minute. I think that was one of the things we were wanting to talk about. But it's funny that we you know, the idea of, you know, I drink black tea with, you know, milk and sugar is like builder's tea and authentically working class, whereas Earl Grey is for posh people. But they cost the same from the shop, right? I mean, it's not as
you can buy
really
50 pack
cheap
of Tetley black tea, which is what I have at the office for, you know.
I was thinking sort of Twinings or something, but maybe that reveals my class already.
Twinings. Wow.
Extravagant.
I do really like buying fancy tea, but not as much as you do.
I buy too much fancy tea.
When I was staying, for the benefit of listeners who have been ignoring thus far.
Don't worry, we'll get to space soon.
When I was staying with Ben recently in New York, because I was between conferences and poor.
No, nothing better to do.
Nothing better to do, exactly. So there was Ben. No. I wanted to visit Ben. Ben's great. Ben has the most phenomenal collection of extremely expensive and bizarre varieties of black tea.
T2 opened near me in New York, and it's good and very expensive. Every time I walk in, it's like getting mugged because they say, "And do you want to try this?" I go, "Yes, I would." And then I drink it, and it's really nice and a bustle.
It was all great tea.
And that costs you $50 when you walk into T2. You're like, "Oh, God.
Gosh, $50?
Yeah.
What are you buying?"
Like expensive tea.
Is T2 designer tea? I just realized it's basically the Nespresso of pod coffee.
Shots fired. Yeah.
Good pun.
Yeah. No, I don't know. And I was just like, what's wrong with Nespresso?
What is wrong with Nespresso?
I usually drink from my AeroPress.
Who's the guy who's in Nespresso ads? George Clooney.
George Clooney.
George Clooney wouldn't endorse anything that wasn't excellent, would he?
No.
Except maybe Gravity.
I thought Gravity was good.
Here we go. Now we're on to space. Did you like
that?
It
was a good segue. I was going to say, I was wondering when you were going to segue.
I was wondering whether we were going to get onto it with your mention of Star Trek and Earl Grey.
I tried to throw you on there.
No,
you
but
know.
I didn't want to. I wouldn't be
cornered. Wouldn't be so gaucious to take a segue that was offered that was suboptimal.
Exactly.
You had to just nail it.
I'm way too proud.
Yourself.
And now here we go.
Yeah.
So, Gravity. Tell us about Gravity, Ben. You enjoyed it.
Well, I really liked it. I thought that as a depiction of the Kessler syndrome, sort of disintegration of objects in low Earth orbit as a chain reaction when one satellite gets struck by material and spreads to all of the others, that was very compelling. And I thought Sandra Bullock was a capable and exciting heroine who was put in basically plausible scenarios. I know some people criticise the science, but, for example, there was this one bit where George Clooney drifts off into space. Do you remember that? I know that people say, well, obviously in space he's not going to fall like that. But in my head I just thought there's some amount of angular momentum that they all have and he's being pushed away. And maybe that's wrong, but it didn't seem weird to me that in a scenario where everyone was spinning around and flying around that there would be, he would end up with the centrifugal force pulling him on a rope or something. I thought basically all of the science, it didn't strike me as horrifying, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of people who go, well, actually, I think we'll find. But I thought it was what I liked about it was a depiction of an exciting scenario involving space exploration that was non-military. So it wasn't all about, like, the aliens are invading. And it wasn't about saving the Earth from asteroids. And it wasn't about conflict. It was about one woman's struggle to survive in a very hostile environment through ingenuity and bravery. And I thought that that kind of humanity struggling for the stars narrative is much nicer than all the militarized sci-fi that we get these days. I thought it was a breath of fresh air.
Well, I'm glad you thought that.
What did you think?
I did not enjoy it that much.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you the truth, which was that I tried to watch it. I got about 10 minutes in
and I stopped.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I agree. I liked the Kessler effect stuff, the debris cloud, all really useful. Mm. And I've used images from it in presentations because it's visually great. But I really didn't enjoy, for some reason, when I watched it, the male characters seemed to be sort of fine, except for the one that was dead. But
yeah, he wasn't okay.
He wasn't all right.
He had a hole in his head.
But Sandra Bullock's character was just like freaking out the whole time. And it was all you could hear because it was just the sound of breathing.
Yeah, exactly. It was a bit much. Yeah.
And I thought that that was, I mean, I'm sure if it was me and I was in that situation, I'd be panicking too. Yeah. But I thought, here's someone who has trained their whole life to be an astronaut. Why is it that she's suddenly more afraid than anyone else? Like she's experienced, she knows what she's doing. Yes, you'd freak out, but I just got really grumpy about it.
But I thought I both agree with you and slightly disagree. Like, as the movie went on, I felt she, there was meant to be an emotional journey where she was freaked out and then at the end she's completely resolute and that she grows into this crisis. And so that gives you a satisfying character arc. And I think if they'd started where she's just like extremely competent and solves the problem, that wouldn't play well as a movie. But I do agree, and particularly like the physicality of all the panting and everything sort of ties into like weird gender discourse about like how men's bodies are neutral but women's bodies are things. And like she's got this extreme physicality to her role involving making lots of noises and emphasis on the physical strain of her activities, which I don't think they would have played with a male character in the same way.
Yeah, no, that's a much better way of putting what I felt. So that's why I didn't finish it. But I may yet go back to it, possibly on an aeroplane at some point. It would be all right.
I thought it was entertaining. I don't know. But I know what you mean. Like, I thought that was jarring too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it is an improvement on the lantern-jawed, all-American male hero of sexism, like in The Right Stuff.
The Right Stuff.
The Right Stuff. What did you think of The Right Stuff?
Well, I watched this for the first time on said, not quite a holiday, but when I was staying with you in New York, drinking all of your really expensive tea.
Yep.
And I sat and I had a cup of very expensive tea and I was super caffeinated because I was incredibly jet lagged.
Yeah.
And I'd also lost my voice because I'd been out clubbing until 4 a.m. every night at the International Astronautical Congress.
Don't we all?
Who knew that space nerds were just such dynamos on the dance floor?
Yeah.
Obviously I am, but I was pleasantly surprised. It was great fun. So I turned up at Ben's place just basically barely functioning because the previous night, so I'd gone out to dinner with someone, then I'd gone to drinks at a bar where like all of the young people who were there had descended on this craft beer bar where they had like 30 craft beers on good. Tap. And then we all went to this random club and went and we're just dancing in Bremen until around 4:30 in the morning. I got a text on my mobile saying that my flight, which was meant to be at 8 a.m., had been cancelled. Anyway, so we all went and got, what do you get? Burritos or something?
Falafels? I don't know. I can't tell you what you got in Bremen.
I don't know what they got. I didn't get one, but everyone else got one.
A currywurst?
And it was like 5 a.m. and I was on the phone to the travel agent here in Sydney who managed to put me onto another flight with a different airline going via somewhere else that was leaving at 9 or something like that. So I was like, well, at that point, there's just no point going to sleep.
No.
So at about 6:30, as dawn was kind of starting to break, I walked back to the hotel, had a shower, packed my bag, walked out of the hotel and got on the tram and went to the airport. And like, it was great because the sun was rising.
Mm.
And at the front of the exhibition hall where the Astronautical Congress was held, they had a rocket.
Don't we all?
Maybe it was DLR or something, But yeah, they just had a rocket sitting there. And so the sun was coming up and this rocket was just like looking amazing. It was beautiful.
That's so cool.
It was really nice. And then I passed out on the aeroplane and got to New York. No issues. Turned up at Ben's place and was just couldn't talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just had to feed me caffeine. And in this state of absolute exhaustion.
This haze
where I couldn't make any decisions. You were like, let's watch the right stuff. And I agreed. But it was a great decision. It was a really good movie. It was a depiction of masculinity and sort of bravery and all of that. It was just wonderful. So much of it was brilliant. But the bit that sticks with me in my head is the part where the bar burns down.
Yeah.
And all the photographs of all the guys who had died being test pilots are just burning up.
The end of an era.
Yeah, the era is over and they don't matter anymore. It's about being the astronauts.
Yeah, and this transition between these people who are at the start of the film, they're like, I want to get my picture up there. What do you have to do to get your picture up there? And it's been like, oh, you have to die. You know, you don't want to get your picture up there. That's super bad luck. And, you know, this idea of like unshowy, unsentimental, you know, old school greatest generation toughness as epitomized by Chuck Yeager. And where people like there's word of mouth in this bar about, actually, Chuck Yeager's the best. Giving way to this mass celebrity of the astronauts. That was really interesting. And exactly, this destroying of their pictures, of the test pilots' pictures, is a really good symbol of this happening. Just
the
like
individual where being sublimated into the nationalistic cause.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it.
I thought that was quite good too.
I approve of that. Yes.
Yeah.
What I thought was fascinating is how appealing they make it all seem. All of this machismo and, you know, nationalism and techno-fetishism that is clearly something we should problematize is presented in such an appealing and compelling way where I guess you get to see the aesthetic from its own proponent's point of view. Almost. Whether or not the film is implicitly critical of this, as a whole, it's really strongly seducing you into this particular conception of the world and of space and of, you know, technology and masculinity. I think that was a really remarkable thing that it did, as opposed to a similar film in principle where they try and interrogate and humanize some of these concepts in a way that I thought completely fell flat as both a form of entertainment and a form of intellectual inquiry. You know which film I'm talking about because we were talking about it earlier.
I think I do, Ben. I'm not going to pretend like we haven't been discussing this movie for some time now.
The First Man sucked. What a bad movie. It's just desperately disappointing.
Really very disappointing.
Yeah.
To be fair, I'm not the biggest fan of Ryan Gosling to begin with. Like, I'm not sort of a devotee of his movies.
But he was wooden.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was trying to play a particular variety of personality that comes across in that manner.
But I guess, so like, one of the things that's so enigmatic about Neil Armstrong as a character is that he didn't like the public eye, that he was taciturn, that, you know, he went back to being an engineering lecturer as most of his career after the spaceflight. He is this enigmatic character, and that's why it's worth humanizing him in a film. But what I thought was such a failure is that Ryan Gosling interpreted a lack of windows into this real person's inner life as a lack of inner life. Armstrong had no internality that wasn't related to his girlfriend's death. Not his girlfriend, his daughter's death, which is sort of like a cousin of this, like, girlfriend in the freezer. That's why I said girlfriend. Like, of the only way that you can motivate men in fiction is through the death of a woman to whom they're attached. And It was just such lazy writing. It's just like, oh, I'm sad about my dead daughter from 10 years ago. Obviously he is, but that was the only emotional note they could bring him to. And he landed on the fucking moon. You know, how can you have no internality about being an astronaut and all of the challenges and rewards that that offers? Like, sure, he didn't, the real guy didn't say a lot about this experience, but that doesn't mean he didn't feel a lot.
Mm.
And I feel that bringing out some of that tension would have been a very interesting film. But instead, it was just one note all the way through.
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because you're quite right. He was completely motivated by the sort of feeling desperately sad and repressing his emotions about the death of his daughter and not talking about it with anyone else.
Mm.
But there was no interaction really with his wife at all.
None.
It was very odd. And maybe I've spoken to some people who thought it was a very realistic movie in the same way that, say, Mad Men is a realistic depiction of that era, that this was a realistic depiction of marriage in that era.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah, it does. But I guess the idea of the man who represses his emotions and the woman who's sort of just, like, they're quite distant.
Yeah.
So that's possible from an emotional perspective. But I did think it was very odd, as you say, that there was nothing else to it. Because I could perfectly well imagine someone not wanting to be in the public eye because they were just a bit shy, or they fundamentally disagreed with the politics of what was going on, or any of those things. And funnily enough, in The Right Stuff, they bring out a lot of that in the characterization and the relationships with the men's wives and whether or not they'll appear on camera or not and all of that. You get a much better insight into why the people are acting the way they're acting.
Yeah.
And in First Man, you don't get it at all. It's just like, here's a guy who's completely single-minded about being an astronaut.
But he's not even very focused on being an astronaut. You see very little of him doing astronauty things. And it's so cruel to the other astronauts. Like, okay, Buzz Aldrin is a well-known character, I guess, in real life. But they play Buzz in a very negative light.
Mm.
The fact that he has been, involved in conflict, I guess, at points in his life, doesn't mean that he doesn't have complexity. And they just played Buzz as an asshole in the movie. And Michael Collins, they first introduce him in the capsule ready to go. You go, okay, I mean, I know he's been erased from history, but Michael Collins is a fascinating guy. His autobiography in Carrying the Flame, beautiful book.
Mm.
I mean, I think the achievement of being the pilot who stayed on the ship is still really interesting. And presumably these guys met each other before they got on the capsule together.
Oh, well, this is the bit I liked least about the film, was that you got to see none of the human interaction that occurred from when they took off and when they landed.
Yeah.
Because that's a period of several days.
Yeah.
They would have been in close confines.
Mm.
It would have been fascinating, even if you took the characterization which they gave, which they made Ryan Gosling play of this guy. Even if you took that characterization, putting that man in close proximity to other people where they all had to cooperate in order to survive would have made this infinitely more interesting, because they would have had to bring out something else in his character.
And actually, the other thing that would have been really interesting is the title of the movie, First Man. This is a fundamental aspect of the story, is who was going to be first.
Mm.
And, Buzz Aldrin in his autobiography, Magnificent Desolation, describes how this really damaged him as a person, was that he'd hoped to be first and wasn't.
Mm.
And that I feel that they could have brought out this drive of Armstrong didn't seem to be doing it for a reason, being an astronaut for a reason, that is. He didn't seem to want anything but his dead daughter. And also, Aldrin didn't have any conflict, any tension. He was just like a bit of a dick in the movie. But no, Buzz Aldrin was a really complex and interesting guy.
Mm.
And they didn't do, like, he did mass on the moon. That would have been a cool story. Instead, we had some made-up thing about Armstrong throwing his daughter's, was it a necklace?
A bracelet
into a crater, which is not historical.
Yes,
it's made
it
up.
Never happened.
Well, I mean, we can't say it never happened, I guess, but I don't think it ever happened. There's no evidence for it. And I think the real things that people did are fascinating enough. And the interpersonal plays, as you say, would have been really cool. Like Aldrin and Armstrong, I mean, didn't necessarily get along extremely well, is my understanding. And that would have been some cool drama. And trying to find out what Aldrin feels about being told he's going to be second, which ends up, as we know later, really influencing his later trajectory as a person. His self-conception hinges on that he was the second man on the moon. And he writes this whole biography about his battle with alcoholism and stuff.
What did you think about the fact that they didn't include the planting of the flag? I know that Donald Trump had some feelings on this one.
Did he? I didn't. What did he say? Did he say something?
Didn't you hear about this?
No, I didn't hear about this.
He tweeted about it and was like, this is an outrage.
Really?
Yeah.
It's weird, though, that now I feel awkward about having been upset by the same movie that Donald Trump was upset by. I feel that we should have different tastes.
Probably. Did you notice that it wasn't in the film?
No.
No, see, I didn't notice that either.
No.
But I reckon maybe if I had been alive at the time that it happened and watching it on TV, that would have been a thing I did miss from the film.
I think it's going to be fascinating when the first archaeologists go to the moon.
Oh, they're keen.
Yeah.
Alice Gorman will be there like a shot.
Oh, man, absolutely.
Yeah, that will be really interesting. Well, of course, Ben, they might find that there's nothing there.
Wouldn't that be funny?
It's all a hoax.
If it was a hoax, but then the archaeologists unintentionally did the first moon landings.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
That would be the sort of thing that social science needs to prove that there's value.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be. Or the meta hoax. What if you could get a team of archaeologists to do a hoax that they did moon landings and found nothing?
Ooh.
What if you could do all the sets really well and have fake moon landings to show that the moon landings were fake?
Let's do this April 1st in like a couple of years.
I think so. People will have forgotten about this podcast. No, we'll just cut this bit out, right? Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So while we're talking about the moon landing,
yeah,
do you want to talk about The Dish?
Oh, I love The Dish. How good is The Dish?
Great film. I saw it for the first time on the aeroplane on the way home from the US.
Fantastic.
Just mere months ago. And I had no idea what a cracker of a movie it was.
So good.
Very good.
One of the great, I think maybe the greatest ever Australian film.
Very good, very funny. And in contrast to First Man,
yeah,
a very sympathetic and interesting depiction of masculinity in Australia at the time. And even the American dude who turned up.
Yeah. I mean, Sam Neill is obviously just my favourite actor. Like, just Sam Neill. Well, not, I mean, that's maybe a strong statement, but Sam Neill is just such a sympathetic character. Oh, you should. Did you see when Julia Zemiro took him around the South Island of New Zealand?
No.
And they just did a chat thing about his childhood?
No.
He's such a nice man. He's a very sympathetic guy. And so they tell a really nice story, even if it's not substantially true. They were using Honeysuckle Creek for the start of the moon landings. They didn't use parks until sometime into the moon landings. And the depictions of the relationships between people at parks is substantially fictional, you know. I think one of the things that's important is, you know, they situate these scientists as being parks people with rural Australian values, but they were intensely networked with the CSIRO in Sydney. And parks had been funded by the United States. Substantially.
Well, I mean, that came out in the film because the guy came over from NASA.
Yeah.
And was sort of
NSF
picking
money.
Up on things.
National Science Foundation. It was one of the largest ever outside the US grants given by the NSF. And so the character that Sam Neill is roughly based on is meant to be John Bolton. There was a really good recent biography by Peter Davidson, which I got for Christmas last year. I got the only copy in Abby's bookshop, so probably no one else can buy it now because it was probably not a very big run. It was called Radio Astronomer. So you can tell how many biographies there are of radio astronomers if you can just call the title of your book Radio Astronomer. It was about John Bolton. He's a fascinating guy. Englishman, came over to Australia during the war, had been involved in radar developments in the British military and ended up working in Sydney. And in complicated ways, he ends up being a pivotal figure in the early CSIRO and in the foundation of radio astronomy in Australia. And then he is recruited by Caltech to start radio astronomy in the United States. And then he comes back to Australia to do parks. And so he's got this spectacular career. But it's fascinating. What we forget is that Bolton is remembered as a visionary, which he was, as a terrific scientist and a very effective manager, which he was. But, for example, Bolton took his position at the CSIRO of power early on explicitly by marginalising in sexist ways Ruby Payne Scott. So it is very interesting to see, in some sense, a hagiographic depiction of a person who was in many ways admirable in terms of his achievements and capabilities, but who did not behave admirably towards everybody.
Well, and again, the characterization in the film, again, he was motivated by the death of his wife.
It's the only thing that motivates men in fiction.
Except the other guy who was motivated by the young woman who brought the sandwiches.
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, that's true.
She was still alive.
Yeah.
She was a bad driver, though.
In the sequel, so she'll be dead, though. That's the only way to make...
Yeah. I thought, though, it was a funny film.
Oh, fuck, it was funny?
Very funny. Loved the playing cricket
in the dish.
Loved the sheep all over the place. It was a film that had Australian humour that still appealed to me as an Australian.
Yeah.
I can imagine it. It's funny because I would have thought it would be quite popular overseas, but obviously Crocodile Dundee is universally.
People, I mean, this relates to Australia's, position in its own psyche and in the world's, is this cultural cringe, this idea that Australia is not a serious place, the idea that Australia is a joke, the idea that Australianness is something to be embarrassed about, or at least humorous about, and that things that we can celebrate in Australianness are these tough macho stereotypes. Right in this bag here, I've got the beautiful book of the Australian Impressionists exhibit, which I just thought was stunning. Really fantastic stuff. But people like John Russell have to go to France to become successful. And they really, it's not so much about Australian Impressionism as Australians participating in Impressionism, which was developed elsewhere. And I mean, we did do really well in art at the turn of the century and don't get enough credit for that. But I think the development of radio astronomy was the first time that science developed in Australia, or an intellectual movement developed in Australia, I should even generalise, spread to the rest of the world which didn't have it. That's remarkable. And that's why The Dish, I think, is a good exemplar of this. Is that, like, we like to talk about, oh, Lawrence Hargrave was great. He did the box kite and he did very early experiments in heavier-than-air flight. But he was basically ignored by his contemporaries overseas. We have to do a lot of special pleading to say that Lawrence Hargrave really was the Wright brothers before the Wright brothers, because really it's the Wright brothers were the Wright brothers in terms of how the rest of the world remembers them, even if maybe the situation at the time with Hargrave was complicated. You know, same with Charles Kingsford Smith, or all of these people in aviation, I think, is another example of a thing where Australians are nearly leading the world and participate very significantly in the early developments, but don't lead the intellectual discourse about it, and don't persist in people's memories internationally.
Is it that they're not leading intellectual discourse, or just that no one's listening?
I think in both. I think both. I think that people weren't listening, people still aren't listening, and that meant that they had limited sway on the discourse internationally. What I really love about The Dish is the way that it has a humane, scientific, and internationalist perspective of Australia and what Australians can be and do. And I think that's the thing I most like about it. I mean, not even just the astronomy is almost irrelevant to me. It's the idea that Australia is a place which is something that serious people can do serious things, that good people can do good things, and that isn't defined exclusively by what it is not, but what it can be.
On the subject of people not listening.
Yeah.
Another great film, Hidden Figures.
Oh, I liked that. Oh, yeah. Yes. I really liked that.
I'm just thinking similar era.
Yeah.
And this time telling the story of a group of marginalised women
instead of
marginalised Australian white men.
Well, I mean, as I was sort of saying, it's actually, well, the marginalised person in the Australian context was Ruby Payne Scott. She was fabulous. She was a communist feminist campaigner. She got sacked because she got married. Anyway, I think I've already ranted about Ruby Payne Scott elsewhere, but that's something I'm very interested in, is these people who get marginalised. And I thought Hidden Figures was terrific for bringing them to the foreground. I thought as a film, some things actually seem disrespectful towards them. Like where they say, does anybody know analytic geometry? And then she has to draw some fucking parabolas on a blackboard.
Mm.
That's not advanced maths, and that's not what she contributed. She contributed some serious stuff. I thought that the scriptwriters really undersell what these women contributed. I thought that that is in itself disrespectful. They pitched it as a humanistic film in which some science was trivial. But I think part of the discourse around science being inaccessible is related to why people from marginalised backgrounds in science are especially marginalised. And it's something about the discourse of how it relates to whiteness and masculinity and power. And so I feel that it was important that they do it right, and they didn't.
Mm.
And I thought that was weird. But otherwise, I thought the film was good. It had been a long time coming.
I really enjoyed it. One of the things I really, really liked about it was the way they had the older white man in the office who basically, you know, gets her working on things and gives her work, but who is not her champion and who basically at the end of it says, well, see you later, you know, and they give her a gift and she's gone. I thought that was a really interesting way of doing it.
Yeah.
And I liked that because it would have been very tempting for them to make him the hero.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I thought it was good that they purposefully did not. I thought it was a good film for a whole range of reasons. I mean, fundamentally, it was just a good movie as well.
Oh, very entertaining. Very watchable. And, you know, it was a story that had to be told. I mean, I'm glad that this particular form of discourse I was talking to you earlier about Arianna Rosenbluth and Ruby Payne Scott and some people like that who I really... I'm picky about being acknowledged. And at the moment, I'm in a battle with the journal editors about citing Elizabeth Alexander as the first radio astronomer to resolve an object, the sun.
Mm.
And her publication on this, only one legible copy we've been able to track down, is in the University of Edinburgh Library. And so the editors don't want me to cite this paper unless I can show them where in the paper it says the thing I say it says, but I'm only able to cite it as a secondary source that's quoted elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I've actually paid for the University of Edinburgh Library to digitise their one copy of it so that we can cite Elizabeth Alexander.
Nice.
She was fabulous. She was a British special agent stationed in New Zealand who, like, did the first radio astronomy, incidentally, as part of her, like, stellar career in geology with an interruption to be a secret agent.
I feel a movie coming on.
She's pretty cool. But this is a really interesting mode of discourse, is re-acknowledging people who have been marginalised from the history of science.
Yeah, I think it's very important to do.
Yeah.
And to do well as well.
As a philosopher of science, what do you think about the interesting position, say, in actor network theory, of someone who contributes an idea and then is marginalised from discourse, that the fields rest upon this invisible set of actors who exert influence without agency?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I wouldn't say I'm an expert in it, but I did write a paper a while ago about the notion of invisible, or in fact, I wrote about the notion of imaginary actors.
Mm.
And I think this ties in. The idea was basically that when you're doing actor network theory, you look at human and non-human actors.
Mm.
And the idea is that you're getting away from any sort of technological determinism by crediting everything sort of equally within a network of influence. So famously, Latour's book, Aramis, has a whole chapter where he writes an imaginary conversation between components of an engine, which is a fun read and could make a great movie, children's film. You heard it here first. But on the subject of imaginary actants, so my theory was that you have in the climate debate, for example, you have this notion of scientists and they're never actually named or cited in the media, but nonetheless they exist in that they exert influence, but they may not actually exist. So they say, oh, well, you know, some scientists say that climate change is not caused by human factors. It's just a natural process and there's nothing we can do about it. In no sense is it necessary for scientists who think that to actually exist. You can just pretend that they exist or say that they exist, invoke an imaginary image of them existing, and that is sufficient to have some sort of influence.
So I guess this is the inverse situation, is that the people do exist.
Yeah, but they don't have any position.
Wiped clean from the discourse.
Within the network.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the people who have the position within the network, as being the person who did the first radio astronomy vision of the sun, and didn't actually do it. So there's also that factor. In a sense, they are also imaginary in that they are a placeholder for a concept rather than anything particularly tangible.
Isn't it interesting how the production of knowledge sure is, you know, mediated by people's relationships, which include power relationships, but the actual knowledge itself has some priority over any power relationships. The things that Ruby Payne Scott showed to be true were true independently of her ability to advocate for them within a network. But because they were taken up by other people, because they had this independent life of their own.
Arguably, they were true whether or not she said they were true.
Yeah, but the social production of knowing them to be true was undertaken in the absence of a great degree of respect or power being afforded to the person who showed them to be true. I think that's quite interesting.
Well, that's a particular
aspect.
You can
absolutely cut across society as this communist person and then, you know, this feminist activist who gets sacked by the government for various reasons that are terrible. But she was still right.
But that's the notion of science, isn't it?
Yeah.
The idea that the knowledge is separated from the person who produces it, which is weird because we actually hold up the individuals who produce particular bits of science as heroes, often, rarely heroines. And in a way, the only way we can demarginalize the marginalized people is by making them heroes too, or heroines in this case.
Yeah.
So that's weird, isn't it? The way that we like to think that science works, which is the idea is independent of the person who puts it forward, is actually not at all the way that science works. Another interesting part of Hidden Figures that I really liked was the notion of a human being a technology. So the women being computers.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, and the way that then the technology comes in as technology, and computer becomes a noun.
Yeah.
It is now a thing.
It loses its animacy.
And then the person must be the programmer who programs the computer. Yeah. I thought that that was a really interesting thing that the film explored, and the way that that shift occurred and the impact it had on the people around it.
Do you think that any of the ways in which we perceive computers to have agency or autonomy, even though they don't, stems from the ways in which they replaced human beings who had agency and autonomy in particular roles? We don't think of abacuses as taking over the world or something, but computers seem to have some kind of personality or desires or wishes or actions.
The rise of the rise of the machine is actually the rise of marginalized women.
Well, do you think we're afraid of the machines taking over because the machines are this sublimation of dehumanized people?
Well, previously, this is really interesting because if you go further back in history, the computers were people of, generally, as I understand it, lower classes, where the people in the universities would send out their calculations broken down into steps to sort of poorer people in the countryside to do and send back. So in that sense, there's a class element there as well, isn't there? That's really interesting. I was thinking about this just the other day when my phone ran out of battery and I said to someone, oh, my phone died. And then I was interrogating that statement and thinking, why is it that that has become the standard way of expressing the fact that a piece of technology has ceased to function because it's run out of a power source?
It's remarkable that we treat... We say it died rather than when it went to sleep, even though going to sleep is a better analogy in terms of the human experience, that we're literally stripping death of its meaning when we think about computers doing this. But also I think that this is leaking into the way in which we see human beings, that death is not of cosmic significance, it's an inconvenience. Have you seen the latest music video by Grimes?
No.
Oh my God. We must see this and almost reconvene in a minute. But do you know Grimes, Elon Musk's girlfriend, the pop star?
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's watch this and then reconvene. God.
Thank you for listening to Space Junk. Part two of the discussion, post-Grimes, will be available next week. As you may be aware, this podcast now has its own email address, which I monitor on its behalf. AI isn't quite there yet, so send your questions, comments, and complaints through to thespacejunkpod@gmail.com. And while you're at it, follow my space research adventures on Instagram as @AnnieHanmer. Granted, I'm only just working out how the whole thing works, and I'm still deeply confused by the concept of sharing square-shaped images with the undefined masses. But I'll admit it's a convenient way to keep on top of trends. God forbid I should venture outside the house without knowing whether scrunchies are cool right now or not. You can also find Dr. Benjamin Pope on Twitter and Instagram as @FringeTracker.